I'm Bert Cohen. We are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So, yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
Oh, smokestack lightning.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
Really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shootings, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
And if you have been around anyone vaguely interested in advertising or marketing, you've probably heard the saying, sell the sizzle, not the steak. Our founders surely never intended political campaigns to be reduced to the level of selling sizzle or marketing detergent, but as was first recognized by Joe McGinnis in the book The Selling of a President in 1968, that is, in fact, what it's largely become, selling the sizzle. Issues and positions are just too complicated. And in the 50 years since the Nixon product sold better than the Humphrey product, the American attention span has shrunk substantially, complicating matters even further is the fact that what's at stake in the upcoming November 2018 elections is truly historic. There are major issues affecting not just the usual slight differences between mainline Democrats and Republicans. Arguably, the solutions we need may be outside traditional, what is generally thought of as the safe center. Led by their president, Donald Trump, the Republican Party has moved in a radical new direction, dismantling as many government programs and oversight on issues like the environment, public education, and many others. And it puts Democrat in a bind as to their messaging strategy. How do they want to be sold to the public? Who decides on messaging? How does it work? With us today, journalist Mike Lillis, who wrote an article titled Dems Look to Decide on Midterm Message for The Hill newspaper. Mike, thanks for being with us.
Senator Cohen, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, I haven't been senator for a few years, but I still take the title. Lillis has covered Congress for The Hill newspaper for the last 8 years. Previously, he was a congressional reporter for The Washington Independent, a now-defunct nonprofit political journalism shop in D.C., covered healthcare policy with Inside Washington Publishers, a trade publication based in Northern Virginia, and served as D.C. correspondent for Iowa's Waterloo Courier. I spent some time in Iowa in 1984 with a campaign. Before entering journalism, he built houses in Thailand, taught English in Prague, raised grain silos in Benin, I'm not sure I pronounced that right, laid water lines in the Philippines, and run kitchens in San Francisco and Alaska. He received a bachelor's degree in English from James Madison University and a master's from Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism. Well, again, thanks for being with us. The title of your article, Dems Look to Decide on Midterm Message. Let's start by defining terms. A congressional campaign consists of many components, all of which ideally should work together like a well-oiled machine. There's the candidate, the product being sold, and the structure, which includes but is not limited to such factors as volunteers, doing the right kinds of tasks, scheduling, getting the candidate to the right places and scheduling house parties and other events, fundraising, the least pleasant but perhaps most necessary part, sign locations, and various consultants, some of whom are highly paid. Please tell us what is meant by the message aspect. What do we mean by the term message? And, well, what's the purpose of the message?
Well, the message is to get voters to the polls and to mark their name by the Democratic candidate. I think it's as simple as that. You mentioned all the operation that goes behind it, which is very nuanced and complicated and expensive, importantly. But, you know, what they're looking for is that bumper sticker slogan that resounds with voters and gets them out in November and not just sitting at home and grumbling about the state of things and feeling disenfranchised. They want to energize voters who are either, just totally checked out because of their disgruntlement with the direction of the Democratic Party in recent years, or because they're angry with the current president. And we, you know, we'll obviously talk about the president a little bit later. But in the meantime, it's interesting that they have taken their playbook out of 2006. This was the last time that they were successful. They won both the House and the Senate in 2006, and both of those were surprises. So they think they have a playbook that they can lean back on. And, of course, it's the same people who are operating the show. It's still Nancy Pelosi. It's still Steny Hoyer. So they think they have the experience to do it, and that's what they're trying to do is take take current events and hone it down into something they can put on a bumper sticker and get people to the polls.
Yeah, I guess it has to be pretty simple. But let's go back to 2006. That was an exceptional year. As you say, they often cite the election as the playbook of 2006. What was the successful playbook back then? What was the message and the platform that turned things around so much? And that, too, was an off-year election like this one is.
Exactly. So the environment was exactly the same. You had a Republican in the White House whose favorability was pretty low at the time, and you had a majorities in Republican majorities in both the House and the Senate, and fairly large ones. So there wasn't the expectation going into 2006 that the Democrats would do very well. But what they did is they focused on economic issues, and they started with a pretty broad platform, and then they pulled some of their issues over the summer, and they picked the most popular ones, and they put those out there under a banner of 6 for 06 was their catchy little phrase, and of course that fit perfectly on a bumper sticker, and it focused on things like lowering healthcare costs, lowering prescription drug costs in particular, raising the minimum wage, making it easier for students to pay back their loans. There was a national security component. Of course, we were the Iraq War was very unpopular at the time, and the 9/11 Commission had issued its recommendations, but the Republican Congress had just sat on their hands, so they promised to adopt some of the 9/11 Commission recommendations, and then there were some green energy provisions in there. It was almost exclusively economic, and they wrote it to surprise victories. They won both chambers, and so they're trying to repeat history with that focus on the economy. Now, I should mention that I think there has been given maybe too much credit to 6 for 06.
You can
remember that that in that year, George Bush was extremely unpopular. The Iraq War was not going well. Bush had tried to privatize Social Security, which the Democrats pounced on. So there were other things. It's often easier to vote against something than it is for something, and people went to the polls that year to vote against George W. Bush, and a lot of the Democrats' success, I think, can be attributed to that. But they still think that the economic message is one that's going to be a winner, and that's what they're trying to duplicate now.
The economic message, well, in many ways, it looks like the economy is doing well, that some jobs being created, the Dow and the other measurements of Wall Street are really up there. So how can they focus on the economy now? That sounds a tad risky.
Yeah, and it certainly will be. And if the economy continues on this route, they're going to have a tough time in November. I think that they realize that. So again, here's an important part. When they first launched this, it's called the Better Deal. Larger, broader campaign this year, and they went out to rural Virginia last summer. They had just been stung by these elections. They had made 2016 about Donald Trump. Everybody was running on an anti-Trump campaign, and of course, they got burned.
Yeah.
So they didn't want to repeat that mistake. So they go out to Trump country in rural Virginia and said, we've got an economic message. And they honed, they focused, laser focus on the economy, didn't mention Trump. And then 10 months later, just this week, they came out with a part two of this campaign message, of this better deal, and it's called A Better Deal for Democracy, and it very much focuses on President Trump and a drain-the-swamp type of message. And they're targeting, you know, some of these cabinet members who are being investigated, the Scott Pruitts at the EPA and Ben Carson at the Housing and Urban Development, Ryan Zinke in the Interior. So they are shifting their focus a little bit, and they are trying to bring a drain-the-swamp anti-corruption, which necessarily means anti-Trump message into the fold,
yeah,
while at the same time focusing on some of the economic issues that they had made a basis for the better deal. And that includes they still want to raise the minimum wage to $15,
right,
for example. Some of the environmental regulations that Trump is rolling back, they want to replace those. The Dodd-Frank regulations that Congress just this week rolled back, they would replace those. Some of the corporate tax cut that was just passed in December by the Republicans, their big legislative victory, they would raise the corporate rate while keeping the middle class, working class rate at a reduced number. So those are the types of nuanced economic messages that they're trying to send. But you're absolutely right that if the stock market keeps climbing and unemployment keeps dropping, that it might ring dull and they might have a tough time in November.
So many things to talk about here. We're talking with Mike Lillis, whose piece in The Hill newspaper is Dems Look to Decide on Midterm Message, Deciding on the Message. And there's so much there that, you know, in 2004, Bush was not that popular, and Kerry ran for president as not Bush. My memory is that, what the heck was he for? You know, and I wonder now, you know, looking back to 2006 as a template, when there was probably more clear and united anger at the president than there probably is now. He wasn't as good a salesperson as Donald Trump is. I wonder, and it concerns me very much that perhaps being anti-Trump, I don't know. What's your thought about that? And then I want to talk about the process, the structure of coming up with a message. So,
right. Great question. They are being, again, they're being very, very cautious not to make this just an anti-Trump message. They know that that didn't work in 2016. They thought it would. They got destroyed at the polls, and they've been licking their wounds ever since, and
yes,
they've been trying to come up with a better strategy. So, when I say, you know, the drain the swamp message is a little bit nuanced, because what they're doing is attacking Republicans on Capitol Hill for not doing proper oversight, for not holding this administration to account, at the same time that they're not exactly Nancy Pelosi is not calling for the impeachment of the president. They're not attacking Trump on that level. They don't think that's a winning strategy, and they don't want to energize Trump's base, which,
right,
which is solid between whatever it is, 32% and 40% in the polls in recent months. That number doesn't seem to fluctuate very much, and they know that they can't get those voters, but they also don't want to get all those voters to the polls. So,
right,
if they can just kind of let Trump do his thing, let Robert Mueller do his thing, they're not trying to jump in and make a lot of hay out of that investigation. They know it's out of their hands. They want to go after the Republicans for not doing their legislative duty, their constitutional responsibility of holding the administration's feet to the fire. Again, knowing that they can't make this just about Trump, they have to stand for something. They have to have their own ideas, their own solid platform that they would do. And again, going back to 6 for 06, it was very successful, not only on the campaign trail, but when Pelosi took the gavel in January of 2007, it took them 100 hours to pass all 6 of their promises, and 5 of them eventually became law. So so they were able to make good on their promises, which I think helped them win the White House in 2008, a couple years later. Now, whether or not they can do that this time around, of course, depends on what happens in the Senate, and Trump, of course, would probably veto everything. But you know, they want to have concrete ideas. They want to be able to, and they want them to be realistic enough that they can make good on them if they do win back control of Congress. And for that reason, you know, that's why the polling is so important. If they come back and all these things poll very well,
yeah,
and they got the public support on their side, then they shouldn't have a ton of resistance to do these things, which is what happened in 2007. You know, the minimum wage is very popular. Part D negotiate, you know, allowing Medicare to negotiate drug prices is very popular. You know, where they might have a stickier time is getting into some of these social issues. Now you're talking about immigration,
oh, yes,
and gun reform and things like that. Those also poll well, but they also are very regional, and they tend to alienate certain voters in certain pockets of the country, in particular some of these crucial swing districts that are a little bit more conservative leaning, and they need those districts, so they have shied away from social issues as well. But that's a different cup of tea altogether.
Oh my goodness, it so is. And you know, eventually in this discussion we'll get down to the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and you know, there are those people who feel like that you have to be pure enough so that if you're not totally pro-choice, we can't support you. If you're not totally pro, you know, marriage equality, we shouldn't support you. I, you know, this is supposed to be government of, by, and for the people. Strange old concept, I know. But, you know, local people have to be able to participate in it. And we've noted that, you know, fundraising is absolutely vital. And I want to talk a little bit about the making of the message. If potential contributors see that a campaign thus far hasn't raised much money, they're far less likely to invest. It costs a lot of money. And like so many other aspects of our capitalist economy, it takes money to make money in a political campaign as well. The message must be part of bringing in the money, and at the same time, shaping the message takes a large share of the money which is raised. So, it, you know, both are going on at once. I wonder if you could talk to us about the structure of how money is spent crafting a message and how much money these consultants get for their work, and you know, how big of a portion of the campaign money is about coming up with a message.
Right, you know, these things seem to get more and more and more expensive. You know,
yeah,
the eye-popping figures that we're seeing now, even in some of these, you know, never mind the presidential race, in some of these House races.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, this is Nancy Pelosi's supporters would say, you know, this is one of her great strengths, and you might have heard that she is a controversial figure, and there mm-hmm. are some who want to push her out, and her response is, nobody raises money like me, and she's absolutely right.
That's
There's
true.
No Democrat up here on Capitol Hill who can pull in money like she does.
Yep.
So, you know, so what happens is you get a national figure like that who runs around the country, and she's raising money at dinners and, you know, however many thousands of dollars per plate. And so, you know, those are either wealthy individuals or they represent some special interest of some kind. And of course they want to get her ear, and they want their ideas to become entrenched in policy. And so she takes that money and showers it on all these Democratic hopefuls in the districts that she thinks where they can win.
Sure.
They run their campaigns, and you know, it is grassroots in the sense that the candidates have been kind of coming out of the woodwork this time around.
Oh, yeah.
Because of the reaction to the president.
Yes.
Have a lot of you know, a lot of veterans, a lot of women, a lot of people who would have never thought to run, mm-hmm. but are so appalled by what's happening in the White House that they say they couldn't sit on their hands any longer, and the Democrats are benefiting from that for sure. Pelosi has always been someone who has advocated for more women in politics,
sure.
and she's just ecstatic this time around at the number of female candidates. So, whether or not that's helpful or not, we don't know. But the, you know, the flip side of that is, and then of course the DCCC, the campaign arm, is out raising money and doing the same thing. They're showering all these candidates with once they pick them. There's a lot of primaries left to be decided. They have to make the tough choice of deciding which candidate has the best shot of winning, even if that candidate might not be the liberal Democrat that they might otherwise choose in a bluer district. But I should mention that you know Bernie Sanders in 2016 also proved that you don't need some huge operation. You certainly don't need the party behind you to be successful. I mean, he ran a very successful campaign on what was it? You know, the $18 contributions or something. I forget what the
27.
Was. I mean, it was just small checks, and it was entirely organic. And so Nancy Pelosi's critics of the DCCC are saying, you know, times have changed with social media. People with a push of a button can contribute these small amounts of cash and really generate some support for other candidates, and it doesn't have to be this big machine anymore.
Right.
So that's an argument that they're having as they talk about leadership
tough.
And as they talk about primaries and whether the party should jump in and who the party should jump in for. And by no means is that debate over. I think it's just going to get more kind of more heated as the year goes on.
Yeah, we are starting in the thick of it now. And there are all these shops in Washington, you know, consultants that get a lot of money. I assume, you know, there's sort of a little bit of mystery and magic as to what they do, how they come up with their messaging. You know, they do polling, they do test marketing. But how much money goes to them? And tell us about, you know, these various different political consultants who they take a lot of money of the campaign, I believe.
They do. They do take a lot of money, and a vast majority of it, I think, goes into the polling, because you can't reach voters unless you know what they like, unless you know what they want. And, you know, so all of that makes sense, but it is an expensive thing. And what you get is a lot of these consultants here in Washington are, you know, old polls, old staffers who have been up here on the Hill. They might have worked on Capitol Hill for a couple decades. They rise up through the ranks. They become a chief of staff. They become somebody important in one of these offices, and then they go to K Street and they can make a lot of money. And of course they have all the contacts. So when somebody in the party wants to, decide who's going to conduct a poll, they say, hey, wait a minute, isn't so-and-so running so-and-so consulting firm? And so it does become very incestuous, mm-hmm. Particularly when you have people bouncing back and forth. You'll have people go to K Street for a few years and then come back and or work on a campaign for a few years and then come back to Capitol Hill for a few years. I mean, people are bouncing back and forth all the time. It's the revolving door that people talk about and often decry. But that is a way of life. It is undeniable. As much as it's criticized, it is very real. I don't. You ask how much money it is. You know, it depends on the campaign.
Right.
But depends on the profile of the campaign. I think that the special election in Georgia recently was a $30 million campaign or something like that. It was the most expensive House campaign in the history of the country, and that was a special case because. Because it wasn't happening along with other election cycles,
right.
And everybody wanted to jump in on it, so you were getting a flood of cash from outside the state. You might be paying these consultants hundreds of thousands of dollars to do some of these polls, and of course a lot is at stake. And if they turn out to be right and you win back the House, then you can do a lot with it. So. It's an expensive process and probably rightly derided for being so.
Yeah, and just doing a poll, I was surprised in 2004 when I ran it turned out to be abortive campaign for U.S. Senate, but just doing a poll back in 2004 was like $30,000, $35,000 for a congressional district. Now I'm sure it's a lot more money than that. It's surprising to, I think, a lot of people how expensive just doing the poll is. Now, some people say, well, why can't a candidate just forget the polls? And some people argue for that and forget the consultants, don't pay them, just be who you are. I think people really, at least around here in New Hampshire, They have a highly skilled sense of authenticity. It's like there's a meter when they go to listen to somebody. And of course, all the presidential wannabes come here. And you know, the authenticity factor matters a lot. Of course, as the great sage Groucho Marx said, sincerity, if you can fake that, you got it made. So you know, I listening to polls, my sense is that I don't know really where Hillary Clinton stood on a whole bunch of issues. It seems like there were a great deal of money was spent on a whole bunch of consultants, and I don't know what the heck the message was. Was there a message of her campaign?
Well, a lot of it was anti-Trump, you know, and yes, of course there was a message. The problem was it just got, you know, like the other 16 Republican right. primary opponents of Donald Trump, it got swept up in the wave of the insanity surrounding the Trump campaign. It was almost overwhelming. There was almost no way to break through that, because everybody was so just kind of mystified. Everybody was so enticed by it. It was so new and unique and crazy. But
well, that counts a lot in advertising. That does, you know, unique and different and capturing the imagination. You know, that's the sizzle we're talking about. And how can you go against that? You know, it's different. It's it grabs the attention of people. And issues, you know, actual policy positions, it's not as much fun when you got a reality TV star. You write that for Democratic leaders, the competition over ideas has been heightened by the changes in the cultural, media, and electoral landscape in the last 12 years since they last took control of the House. End of quote. Please say more about those changes that you're talking about. What are the different dynamics this year from that amazing year of 2006?
Well, you know, obviously, when I started in journalism a few years before that, we were still writing one story a day for the newspaper, and everybody was still getting the paper on their doorstep. Yeah. And
24 hour cycle.
It's almost too obvious to say, but the speed with which news travels, and the profusion of social media, has just changed the landscape to such an extent that the two are barely comparable at this point. So when they go back and look at 6406 and how they got the message out, that's different than saying, you know, how they crafted it. They can still do the same polling, you know, that type of stuff hasn't really changed. They can still come up with just a handful of bullet points that, as you said, don't get too deep in the weeds, that don't bore people to death.
Right.
You don't want people's eyes to glaze over when you're talking about these things.
Yeah.
So that stuff is all consistent. What has changed is just the media landscape and the speed with which news travels, and really the risk of, you know, one tiny slip up. You know, these people are traveling all over the place, campaigning. They're in grocery stores. They're on cable news, and you know, one slip up and one viral video can sink a campaign in a minute. You know, so there's a lot more at risk, which is why they're very, you know, I think they're much more cautious now than they were in the past. They just don't want to make a mistake that can sink a campaign.
Yeah, that's interesting, the use of the word cautious. Sorry for interrupting, but, you know, I wonder if the Democratic insiders and these consultants are really, they must be getting the different dynamics of the 24-hour news cycle and the social media. And that whole thing about caution, you know, there's got to be a balance between specifics that fire people up and vagueness to avoid making mistakes. I wonder if the people who come up with these things, it must be more challenging for them now than it was 12 years ago.
Oh, absolutely, because it's so easy to find, you make a campaign promise, and then it's just out there, and it's never going to go away. And if you don't make good on it, somebody's going to remind you of it, you know, probably on Twitter, probably on Facebook, on things that are going to reverberate at light speed around the internet.
Yeah.
So it's you're right. You have to be you have to offer certain things specifically, but keep them vague enough that no one's going to pin you down on them, and really go after you if for whatever reason you can't make good on them. You know, you don't want to be accused of being of lying in your campaign message, or you don't want to be accused of being a hypocrite or flip-flopping or any of these things. you know, that said, Donald Trump has proven that that there are exceptions to rules, and that changing your mind hasn't hurt him with his base. Certainly, he made specific promises that he is just totally reversed himself on since coming into office, and it hasn't hurt him at all. So, who knows? It's tough to make predictions anymore. After 2016, we stopped making predictions up here on Capitol Hill. I don't know about you in New Hampshire, but we didn't know what to do anymore. So
that was
I'm out of the prediction business. And again, that's which is why no one really knows what's going to happen in November. Is there going to be a blue wave? Are the Dems going to take the House? No, you know, it's just an impossible question to answer until it happens.
Yeah, and writing in the New York Times, Russ Douthat opines, a campaign that harps too much on the president's outrages risks playing into Trump's hands. One dumb way would be to just rehash Hillary Clinton's failed, look how terrible this guy is, messaging. I know it's. I wonder how it could play into Trump's hands. I mean, certainly the Republicans are jumping all over the idea that, if you elect Democrats, they'll try to impeach this president. So that fires up the 35% to 40% base of them. But, we can't just do the look how terrible this guy is, which has got to have a lot of consultants scratching their head, because he is pretty terrible. And he's, you know, the consistency, there's no consistency whatsoever. And in 2016, the Trump message was clear. There was no question what the Trump message was. I don't remember what, if anything, the Hillary message was, but the Trump message was MAGA, Make America Great Again. Why did that work?
Well, first of all, I reminded people that particularly in the middle class, that their lives weren't, you know, their wages were stagnated. A lot of people didn't have jobs. They were still feeling the pain of the Great Recession, which, you know, the recovery from that has been has affected different income levels at different rates, at different speeds. And so it reminded people that they were better off before that. Certainly, Trump was not just attacking Hillary Clinton. He was attacking Barack Obama. He said everything that he ever did was failed and a catastrophe. You know, he used big, booming words. He wasn't afraid to go out on limbs. And he wasn't afraid to attack everybody in his way, every critic, and it didn't matter how accurate he was. He just spoke in very general terms that he would make things better, and he was a deal maker who was properly poised to do it. And obviously it reverberated in the just the right parts of the country. And so when you say Clinton didn't have a message, again, she did. She just couldn't break through. But also, she was targeting the wrong place. She was targeting places that had been traditionally Democratic, and she didn't think she had to work there, and she got burned. Well, so, you know, it's also part of the strategy is not just the message, but where you send it.
Ah, that's a good point. But that message, Make America Great Again, I mean, from my sense of messaging, is that it's like ideal, because everybody gets it. It's really short, fits on a bumper sticker really easily, and you can project what you want on that Make America Great Again. I don't know if Democrats can do that. I mean, you know, we've already talked about the message of a better deal. It seems I've heard that for quite a while. I wasn't sure if actually that was in play in 2016. I thought it may have been. It must have been poll tested, otherwise they wouldn't even be considering it. They meaning the, you know, the insiders and the consultants. What is it that they like about that message, a better deal? Why do they think it'll work? How do they think it resonates? Or is it just that it's vague enough not to pin anyone down? What about that message, a better deal?
Yeah, it is almost certainly poll tested. They didn't just pick it out of a hat. There's no doubt about that. I think they were playing, you were absolutely right. They want to keep it vague. Nothing more vague than Make America Great Again or a better deal,
right,
or something like that. What does that mean? You have no idea. And anything and everything fits beneath it, and you can tailor it to however you like. I think they were playing on, you know, on a New Deal, on the Roosevelt New Deal, which of course was not many people alive to remember it, but very popular at the time, and they want to go back to the, to that message that government is worth trusting and can be a force of good in this country, as opposed to Trump, who thinks that that it just messes everything up.
Yeah.
And you know, the Paul Ryan and the Republicans, their message is called a better way. So I think it was a way to play off of the Republicans as well and try to one up them. So somewhere between a better way and a new deal, they found a better deal. And of course, the Republicans are mocking them for copying them. But that's one of those inside the Beltway nuances that nobody cares about anywhere else. So Pelosi doesn't care about the mockery from Paul Ryan, but I think the important part of that is that yes, it's vague. They can put anything under there that they like. They could introduce it early in the cycle. Again, this is it was last July that they launched this thing, and then just like they did in 06, they'll poll test the proposals that they've put out under the umbrella of a better deal. They'll do that this summer, and then you can look to maybe mid or late August as they're getting back in town after the August recess, that they'll release the results of those polls and they'll narrow it down to something like a 6 for 06. They have not decided whether that will be specific policy proposals like it was 12 years ago, or if it will be broader themes. They still want to talk to all their consultants. They want to look at the polls. They want to talk to their members up here and see what people think. But, you know, it's an evolving process, and we'll just have to see where it goes. But the point being, yours exactly, a better deal is vague enough that they can do anything with it.
Yeah, they can hang anything off of those bones. Before reading your, and we talked about the Washington insiders inside the Beltway, I had never not heard before reading your column of the Democratic Policy and Communications Committee. What is this, and what are they already doing this cycle?
It's a great question. You remember after 2016 when there was a revolt, there was a mini coup in the Democratic Party, in the House Democratic Party. Nancy Pelosi's been here too long. She can't win. We got to throw her out and get some fresh meat in there. Get a fresh face in there. Somebody younger. Somebody who can speak to the voters that Nancy Pelosi alienates in some of these more swing districts. And she beat that revolt down pretty easily. Tim Ryan from Ohio ran against her. He got 63 votes. She got 150 or something like that. She killed him 2-1. So she still has the broad support within the caucus. But to appease the 63, in essence, she broadened the leadership structure. She said, okay, you guys, you know, younger generations, you want more power, you want more say. Here it is. And she created some of these new leadership offices it's all under her direction, so it's a little bit misleading. But there are some faces that are running around trying to help with the message, and that office that you mentioned, the DPCC, is one of them. And it's run by Sherry Bustos, who is a Democrat from Illinois, from central Illinois, which is went for Trump by 12 points or something like that. And Hakeem Jeffries, who's up in Brooklyn, a member of the Black Caucus, and David Cicilline in Rhode Island. So there's three of them who are running the show. They're different genders, different ethnicities. They're trying to show diversity, and they're trying to broaden the leadership to quell some of the uprising, because Pelosi and Steny Hoyer and Jim Clyburn have been there for more than a decade, and there's a lot of grumbling about that there's this bottleneck at the top and there's no place to move up, and so a lot of Democrats have been leaving. Some are running for governor this year, some have gone to the Senate, some have just retired, and so there's nowhere to go. So she's trying to put down some of those concerns at the same time that she's trying to win back the House by carving out this message and giving them some power to help with that process, I guess.
Well, it seems to make sense. And for those who may have just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest is Mike Lillis, who wrote an article called Dems Look to Decide on Midterm Message. He writes for The Hill newspaper. And you are probably one of the very few people in the world who knows all 435 members of Congress. Wow.
That is a distinct impossibility the way that these guys come and go.
It's amazing. It's such a huge bunch of people, a couple of egos here and there. You know,
just one or two.
And, you know, we talked about the Washington insiders, the DCCC, and all these expensive consultants. There are a lot of primary campaigns already underway. We've had some interesting results already from some of them. And, well, let's just stop there, actually. And I wonder if certainly some of the old insiders and consultants, you know, who want to play it safe all the time, how are they dealing with some of the insurgents that are doing so well? Do they think it's just an aberration, or do they must be scratching their heads over what the heck is going on, because it's outside of their vague predictability and safe center?
Well, you know, it's a great question, and the it's one of those issues where they almost have too much, almost too much of a good thing. And because of President Trump and kind of the backlash to his presidency, particularly among liberal Democrats, they've just had this outpouring of interest in candidates and people wanting to run and come to Washington to change how things work. And so in some of these districts that the Democrats here in Washington think they have a great chance of winning, there might be, you know, 8, 9, 10 primary candidates,
sure,
in some of these races, at
oh,
least
yeah.
at the beginning.
Right.
And so part of their job has been to winnow that field and get a sense of who, you know, who's the most sellable candidate, who's got the best resume, who's got the best background, who's the most articulate, who can do the fundraising, who has roots in the district, all of these considerations. And they've taken some heat because leaders have bounced around the country while they're raising money, and they'll sit down with some of the other candidates and try to convince them to step out of the race for fear of for fear of tanking it, for fear of taking resources
really
from the proverbial candidate. And some of the, you know, the grassroots folks are up in arms that
yes.
the DCCC or Steny Hoyer or Nancy Pelosi or somebody might do that. And there was just an embarrassing tape that was released of Steny Hoyer out in Colorado telling a liberal primary candidate that he should step out of the race because if he wins the primary, he's not going to win the general. And it was embarrassing for the Democratic leadership here, but there's nothing new about that. I mean, that's just how it works, and both parties are doing that. You know, they want the best chance of winning, and they don't want some upstart to come in who doesn't have a chance of winning and blow the thing up. Now, the flip side, the argument against that is, well, how do you know if the upstart can't win if you don't let him win the primary? And, you know, which was kind of Bernie Sanders' argument in
exactly.
2016. The DNC, of course, tipped the scales for
Hillary
Clinton, and his supporters aren't soon going to forget it, nor is Senator Sanders himself. And so they think that they were just denied the chance to do it, and they think that they could have beaten Trump. So, you know, that's a debate that's not going to go away, but all those things are happening, and it's certainly not exclusive to the Democrats. That's both parties who are doing it. But back to the there are tons of primary candidates, and it's a difficult decision for them to pick which horse you know they want to get behind, and in some of these races they're just hands off, they're just letting it go because there might be more than one good candidate and they don't want to interfere. So they're doing it district by district, and it's a lot of work.
It certainly is, and I the DCCC, a lot of people frankly don't like them. They feel like, you know, they're all about themselves and keeping themselves in business here and picking winners. And it actually, in 2006, as I recall, in Congressional District 1 here in New Hampshire, the DCCC endorsed one candidate, and the insurgent not only won the primary, but has been member of Congress for quite some time. That's Carol Shea Porter. She was the insurgent. I don't know. I get the sense that, you know, again, we're talking about marketing here, and isn't insurgency kind of fun? Doesn't it attract attention? And so much of this these days is entertainment. I mean, Trump was very entertaining in 2016. He was nuts, in my opinion, but and still is. But entertainment is a big part of it. And the whole insurgency thing, people like that kind of thing. And there's this tension, and it's probably there in the Republican races as well. You know, the people on the ground who are tuned into their district versus the, you know, high-powered, well-dressed consultants who often come in at the last minute and tell everybody how to do it. That's been a situation for many decades that, you know, the people on the ground put it together, and then at the last minute, the Washington insiders come in. You get any sense about how that's playing out already, that tension?
Well, you know, that'll certainly turn people off if they think that Washington is running the show and
yes.
not letting the district, you know, choose its own candidates and things like that. And everybody, as you said, everybody loves a good insurgency. Trump was living proof
yes,
of
true.
That.
Yeah.
And I didn't know the history of Carol Shea Porter. That's fascinating. I didn't realize that. I'll have to talk to her about that the next
yeah.
time I see her. But, you know, I think what's happening this year is there are not a lot of primary challengers against sitting Democrats. We're not seeing that
true.
Dynamic.
That's for sure. Yeah.
You know, what you're seeing more of is either vulnerable Republicans and the Democrats dumping a bunch of money into those races, and that's where you're having, you know, 5, 6, 7 primary candidates wanting to challenge vulnerable Republicans, or you're having retiring Republicans. I think was the number up to 40 or something like that. An incredible number of veteran Republicans who are bailing, who are just getting out of town and won't be back next year. So there's an open seat, and that, of course, is a pickup opportunity in a lot of cases for the Democrats. And so there you're having primaries on both sides of the aisle. The Democrats and the Republicans are both having primaries. So that's more of where the primary races have been and where they'll continue to be over the summer. I can't think of another. There was Congressman Pittenger in North Carolina became the first incumbent lawmaker this year to get picked off. A primary opponent down in North Carolina won that a couple weeks ago. So, but he was the anomaly so far. We're just not seeing that type of insurgency. So it's not quite an insurgency year on that level because nobody's going after the incumbents. Within their own party, I mean. And I'm trying to think if there's another example of that. I just can't off the top of my head think of any Democrat who's facing a tough primary challenge this year. Can you think of any?
I can't think of any either. Democrats, you know, are, I think, largely wise enough to say, hey, if we have the seat, the person may not be perfect, but let's hang on to it. We need them.
Right, we really
do. And the political insiders traditionally have always insisted that going for the center is the only way to win. They see themselves as the pragmatists compared to the unrealistic idealists. They figure average voters are not ready for Medicare for all and a $15 minimum wage. Other people at this time see the dynamic that there's a hunger, a yearning for boldness, even what might be called radical ideas and message. I mean, certainly a lot of the insiders, the term radical just freaks them out. You know, they run for the hills. What's your sense? There must be some testing going on about even the term radical and boldness. What's your sense of all that?
Oh, sure. I mean, it's a fight of semantics. You know, they're testing everything, and language would be at the top of the list probably. I think it's, you know, it's fascinating because, as you mentioned, there's 435 districts in the country. No two are alike. And so they really do have to be careful about, you know, carving a very specific national message that's going to alienate people in different parts of the country. So they keep it vague, and then they really hone in on it in a district-by-district level. In some of those districts, the radical idealist is going to win. I mean, some of those districts are perfectly suited for that type of a message and of course, would get the full support of the Democratic Party. In others, the centrist message might work, and still others, even further to the right-leaning message is going to work. You know, we just saw this Connor Lamb race, this Pennsylvania race, where Tim Murphy had to resign. And this is Trump country. This was 20 points for Trump not that long ago. And the Democrats haven't run an opponent in the House race in 2 cycles, in 4 years. I mean, that's how safe it was for the Republicans. And along comes this young 33-year-old Marine named Connor Lamb, and he won. He's in Congress now, and so the Democrats, of course, were encouraged by that, and they think that they can win any race if they've got the right candidate and the right message, and you know they're being very careful not to criticize anything that he said. You know, he had to take out an ad saying that I won't support Nancy Pelosi, and it seemed to help. He won by less than 1,000 votes, so it was close. There's no way to tell how many of those voters were responding to his anti-Pelosi message, but it couldn't have hurt in that district. And, you know, he was very careful not to, you know, not to go after the Second Amendment, although he did support some of the, you know, the background check provisions and things like that that the Democrats are making a campaign issue. So, you know, it's all about nuance. It's all about the delivery. If you can, I think Bernie Sanders is living evidence of that. In a lot of circles, he is considered the radical idealist, and yet his, you know, his radical ideas were reverberating throughout the country, even in some of these deep red districts. So, you know, the delivery has a lot to do with it. It becomes a cult of personalities in a lot of cases. And if you've got the right person delivering the speech, it almost doesn't matter what they say. And Trump is proof of that.
The whole cult of personality, the celebrity thing, really bugs me. I must say. I mean, many years ago, when I was in the state senate, I was at this event, and somebody said, "Oh, I'm sitting next to a celebrity." I'm thinking, "I'm not a celebrity. I'm a state senator." But people want celebrity, and the whole TV and just that whole dynamic is bothersome to me. And it's reality. It is reality. And you know, here we have an election coming up now, where, let's face it, in 2016, a lot of people didn't vote. That's a big number of people. You know, you can go for your Democratic base. The Republicans can go for their Republican base. It's a little more risky to go for the people who were turned off last time, who Hillary thought she had in the bag, but just didn't bother voting. I wonder how that's... I can't help but think that the Washington insiders recognize that there's a lot of fertile ground out there, that people are angry and they feel left out, they feel powerless, they want to feel some power, and the traditional ways of going for them, you know, being pragmatic and centrist, I don't think it's going to work. They must be getting that message now. And just to further, before you answer, my sense is that message making is a lot more decentralized now than it has been before. And that, I imagine, some insiders see this as an unwise development. So I just said a whole bunch of things. Maybe you can react.
Well, you know, certainly on a national level, they're the consultants who want to make it a national message because they're getting paid to do that very thing.
Yes.
They would be the first to criticize any decentralization of that. That doesn't mean it's wrong to do so. And I think, you know, it's important to dig into these districts and find that, you know, that balance, that message that really resounds with voters there, and only somebody who's there would know the answer to that. So there's the decentralization. It's almost, you know, it's just by necessity. You can't have everything dictated out of Washington. It'd be a disaster. Certainly everyone here knows that this is a midterm cycle, and
And
you mentioned that the voting numbers were down in 2016 in a presidential cycle, and they'll be much lower than that this time.
For
so
sure.
Everybody is trying to get out the vote. That's always what it's about. It's not usually about changing minds. It's about energizing people who would already vote one way or another to just stand up and walk down to the polling office and check a box.
Yeah.
Because they're pretty sure once they get there, they know who they're going to vote for. That hasn't changed in 1,000 years. I think, you know, in this case, when they're looking at a particular message, the Democrats, I mean, again, we talked about Trump's 35% to 40%. You're not going to change their mind. You hope that you don't energize them with your message. That would backfire. You want it, you know, the liberals, the people who came to the women's march on the day after Trump's inauguration. You don't want to lose that energy. You want to get those people all to the polls. You want to get them knocking on doors. And so, you know, those are the two wings, the two far reaches of the spectrum. And then there's that group in the middle that that might have voted for Obama and then voted for Trump, or, as you said, just didn't show up in 2016. And the trick is to get them. And, and I think a lot of this, a lot of the paid consultants and a lot of the polling is focused exclusively on that group. If they can find out where they are and if they can get them to the polls, then that'll be the election right there. That'll be the deciding factor. Who's going to take the speaker's gavel? Who's going to control the Senate? And of course, in 2020, who will be in the White House?
That's an interesting point to. That the focus is probably on, it makes a lot of sense, I think, as you explain it, to go for the lazy Obama voters, the people who voted for Obama in 2008 and probably 2012, but didn't in 2016. There's probably a lot of numbers there, and that's probably a good thing to narrow your focus on in terms of message. What about the simple, easy-to-understand message of, I mean, there was the Make America Great Again. What about the message of Medicare for All? Don't people all I mean, I would think everybody feels like their insurance is way too expensive, too difficult. It's a mess. Medicare for All. I wonder if that's got to be being poll tested. I mean, it clearly worked for Bernie. I think people understand it, and it's something that can resonate. What's your sense of how that might be playing?
I think it depends on the messenger. I don't think that, you know, Bernie had a wonderful time with it, and it resonated with people. I think people do understand what Medicare is. It certainly polls very popular. But, you know, then you have this crowd that says, you know, keep the government off of my Medicare. It's a crowd for which there's not the recognition that Medicare is a government program. You have to contest with that in certain parts of the country, I think, which complicates things. After Obama and the Democrats spent, you know, a year and a half and hundreds of hearings and everything that they did to get Obamacare through, and you'll hear Nancy Pelosi say this over and over again, why aren't you for Medicare for All, she gets asked. And she says, for 30 years, I was for Medicare for All. I was the one in San Francisco walking down the street calling for Medicare for All. But we created this law. We fought for it. We think it's great, and we don't want to abandon it. We thought, you know, it was our version of compromise. It kept the insurance companies in business. You know, it didn't just dismantle the entire healthcare structure that had evolved over the decades. She says we just want to fix that. So if we were starting from scratch, I'd do Medicare for All, but we're not starting from scratch, so let's just fix Obamacare, and that should be our message. And so that's kind of where they're coming from. But I think you're right. And, you know, certainly in pockets of the country, and certainly with liberal Democrats, Medicare for All is the way to go, and anybody who doesn't push for it is kind of a traitor, including Nancy Pelosi. I mean, you're seeing some of these groups go after her for embracing it. But again, who knows if it would work in all parts of the country? Yeah, which is the fear. If you start doing those sorts of things, you know, an assault weapons ban, is that something you want to make a national message, or do you just want to have some Democrats in some districts where it's popular use that to try to come to Washington? It's a balance that they're trying to find.
Yeah, the messaging between specifics and vagueness. Got to be just the right mix. Well, it's been very, very interesting. Mike Lillis, if listeners want to read more of his stuff, he's on The Hill, which is online. Great, interesting paper. I can't live without it, I'll have to say. But then again, I'm a political junkie, and not everybody is.
You would have to be.
That's true. Well, more and more of us are. Well, thank you so much. Messaging is so interesting and important and more complicated than probably a lot of people thought. Thanks, Mike Lillis, for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive.
Senator Cohen, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate the time.
Thank you. And here's a clear message from Afrika Bambaataa and James Brown.
Everybody over there!
Seeking education! Everybody over here!
We all need respect!
All the people of the world!
Hoping for peace!
Everybody thank!
time he left.